Blog Talk Radio.
Show Getting It Done. What you're about to hear is the history of black athletes in this country. We know that slavery began in the 1500s, and that's in this country, of course. And men were used in a lot of different ways besides working on the farm or in the big house, as it was called. And some were fighters, and others were jockeys that raced horses, and owners made lots of money betting on them to win or to lose. After slavery, the slave owners could not make money from them boxing or even horse racing. These were the two sports that black men excelled in after slavery. So let's listen to see what happened after that. And this will be hosted by Samuel Jackson, actor extreme. Let's listen.
10 years after the Civil War, America was becoming an industrial nation, slowly moving from the farm to the cities. Leisure time is now part of the American lifestyle. And sporting events are the new news.
Black people felt that there were two problems with. One is that it seemed to be sort of wasting time. You seemed to be not doing any kind of enterprise that seemed to be moving the race forward. And then, two, it was a problem with you're doing this for white people. I mean, the audience for this is mostly white people.
African Americans were in a state of uncertainty. Many who pursued business endeavors faced fierce opposition by whites. As black Americans struggled to find their place in society, they put to use skills learned on the plantation.
A white slave owner who had a lot of slaves would have a number of slaves who were skilled. And a number of these slaves were, of course, groomers and horse trainers.
1875 was the first year of the Run for the Roses, and it showcased the country's best jockeys. 13 of the 14 jockeys were black.
Black people naturally got involved in sport, dealing with some of the activities they were dealing with on the plantation, horses being one of them.
Well, you take back food. All those jocks come out of riding families. All the grooms come out of grooming families. All the trainers were handed down. You know, that's the way that went.
So you have black people really dominating a sport like horse racing, and that's how you got a legendary name like Isaac Murphy when they... Kentucky Derby, I believe, three times.
Born in Fayette County, Kentucky, on New Year's Day, Isaac Murphy was the son of a Union Army soldier who had died in a Confederate prison camp. At age 15, Murphy raced in the first Kentucky Derby. He did not win that day, but his career flourished at a time when black jockeys had few peers.
They were trainers. You had plenty of black trainers. Yeah, you had black jockeys. You had it all, ain't it?
African American jockeys won 11 of the first 20 Kentucky Derbies. Isaac Murphy made $10,000 a year. almost 10 times the salary of the average white person, a fact that did not sit well with many Americans. Eventually, the Jockey Club was formed, and blacks were denied licenses to ride. As each year passed, black jockeys slowly disappeared from America's track. They left legacies like Isaac Murphy's winning record of 44%, a feat yet to be equaled. By the turn of the century, tolerance for integrated sports was waning. Bicycle racing was one of the most popular sports in the country, and Major Taylor was the fastest bicycle rider in the world. For Taylor, racing was exciting and dangerous.
They were racing through a town, and they would go through the main street and then out around the edges of the town, and that there were certain groups, and they'd do things like throw broom handles through the spokes or other riders who would try to bunch up and keep him from getting around them.
Taylor rode on to become the American and two-time world cycling champion before he was outlawed from racing in the U.S. by the League of American Wheelmen. Even the All-American pastime did not want black Americans. Baseball's foremost player, Cap Anson, refused to play a game against Toledo because Moses Wheaton Walker was on the team. Anson's actions encouraged an unwritten ban on blacks in Major League Baseball that would last over 50 years. The push for segregation was so strong that the Supreme Court upheld Plessy versus Ferguson and separate but equal became the law of the land.
We're coming to the end of the century, the beginning of the 20th century, the century that everybody calls the American century, that America was really the special place of Anglo-Saxon destiny. America was going to be the most powerful country on earth. It was going to be the new empire. And also it was commonly believed by many white people that black people were going to die out.
America was divided as never before. White America had suffered the prowess of blacks in many sports. But the sport of sports, boxing, was still a white man's domain. The greatest fight boxers had always refused to fight blacks. But now, a new black man was on the scene. He was brash and self-confident, and he could back it up with his fists. His name was Jack Johnson. Considered a great defensive fighter, Johnson made his way in the boxing world by fighting in California, where boxing was big business. By 1907, Johnson had defeated all major black challengers, like Sam Langford and Joe Jeanette. He set his sights on the real prize, the heavyweight championship of the world.
This title means a great deal to people because it's sort of like your Mr. American manhood or something. And the idea that a black would be the most idealized man in the United States bothered a lot of people.
Lacking light competition, the beloved heavyweight Jim Jeffries retired a champion. Eventually, a short Canadian named Tommy Burns took the title. Burns was in no hurry to fight Johnson either, and he avoided it.
Jack Johnson had chased Tommy Burns to Australia, where a promoter offered Burns $30,000 to fight Johnson. Burns couldn't receive this type of money fighting a white fighter, so he agreed.
On December 26, 1908, Johnson got his chance.
The belief was that blacks physically were hard-headed and weak in the stomach. Now, Jack Johnson realized this, and so he exposed his stomach and kept saying, go ahead, hit me, Tommy, hit me, Tommy. And Burns kept trying, and of course, it was hopeless.
Burns was no match for Johnson, and in the 14th round, Johnson knocked Burns out. The camera stopped rolling just short of Burns hitting the canvas. Many Americans said the fight should never have happened. With the victory, Johnson became bolder than ever, flaunting his title and his women.
He was a man whose sex life had certainly become public. He was a man who was reviled and hated by white people. It was all political. It was all simply that a white man must be heavyweight champion. We can't stand the idea of a black being heavyweight champion.
Almost immediately, the call went out for a great white hope. The reporter Jack London spoke for many Americans.
But one thing now remains. Jim Jeffries must now emerge from his alfalfa farm and remove that golden smile from Jack Johnson's face. Jeff, it's up to you. The white man must be rescued.
Overweight and out of shape, Jeffries declined to fight Johnson, but the call grew louder. After 2 years, Jeffries finally agreed. Promoter Tex Rickard built a stadium in Reno, Nevada to hold the fight.
Reno was beyond the pale. Reno is gambling. Reno is drinking. Reno is prostitution. Reno is the hometown for sports throughout America. The perfect place for the fight. And as the fight grew closer and closer, attention throughout America built.
Gamblers, prize fighters, and aristocrats descended upon Reno, forcing the frontier settlement to become a big city almost overnight. America was focused on this desert town in Nevada. A superstitious man, Johnson entered the ring first. The fight of the century was about to begin.
I was 9 years old. They had this fight that was going on someplace, I don't know, remember where it was, but I do know that Jack Johnson was fighting Jeffries. The young boys had come out on the bicycles from Western Union to bring the rounds.
By round 15, Jeffries was bleeding and swollen. Johnson had victory at hand. As he piled up points, the only person seen rooting for him was his wife, Etta Duryea. With each punch landed, Johnson chipped away at the ideals of the nation. Never again would the heavyweight title be only the white man's domain.
And when the fight ended, it was just silence. Nobody cheered. People filtered out of the stadium as if it was a wake, as if they were mourning the passing of something, which they were.
When they said that he had knocked out, that Jack Johnson knocked out Jeffries, well, the place was just in an uproar. Everybody was so happy.
As soon as the fight ended, the riots began.
Terribly, blacks were killed. In New York, throughout the South, in cities large and small, and they would just attack. White mobs would attack blacks.
Johnson returned to Chicago. His drinking and carousing increased. Often short on cash, he fought any great white hope sent his way. Openly taunting his challenges, Johnson's showboating was considered a bad example for the nation's Negroes. The FBI launched a movement to rid the country of the champ. 1 month after Jeffries' defeat, Judge Kennesaw Mountain Landis charged Johnson with transporting white women across state lines for immoral purposes. Found guilty, Johnson fled the country. When he returned years later, he returned not as a champion, rather as a criminal. Across America, blacks were shut out of all aspects of mainstream American life. D.W. Griffith's Birth of a Nation reflected the beliefs and sympathies of many Americans. African Americans looked to their own communities for survival, and the Harlem Renaissance was born. Harlem was an inspiration to scientists, thinkers, and artists. Stage plays, new forms of music, and economic strides energized the black community. For the first time outside of sports, African Americans were becoming international stars. Even so, one of the most noted got his start on the gridiron.
I was told when I was a kid, well, we want you to go with Paul Robeson. You know, I mean, Paul Robeson was out there with W.B. Du Bois. I don't know of any other black athlete who was quite seen in that way as Paul Robeson is, as this kind of quintessential scholar athlete.
In the 20s, Paul Robeson was scoring points on the American stage. His versatility allowed him to play Othello or sing in concert. But his career actually began by making touchdowns on the field. After attaining the highest marks ever achieved on the New Jersey High School exam, Robeson entered Rutgers University in 1915 on an academic scholarship. That same year, Frederick Douglass Pollard entered Brown University as the only black members of their teams. Playing the game held special challenges.
They called me all the niggas in the world. But I kept on making long runs and didn't get laid out and whatnot, so they just stopped.
Pollard played in the very first Rose Bowl game and was the first black running back named to Walter Camp's All-American list. He slowly gained the respect of his teammates, and they did what they could to ensure he would be able to play.
They wouldn't allow me to have a place to change my clothes. I had to change my clothes in the cigar store, and I had to get a cab and with two or three white fellas and go from there. And the Brown team went out there, and I had to go after just 3 or 4 or 5 minutes before they blew the whistle. And we had it all figured out.
Pollard went on to become the first African-American quarterback and head coach in professional football. As coach of the Akron Pros, he was highly regarded, especially by his one black player, Paul Robeson. Eventually, the NFL would ban blacks, and regardless of his winning record, Fritz Pollard would be out of a job. It would take over 50 years before the NFL would have its second black head coach. Paul Robeson would achieve superstardom off the field. As the progress of the 20th marched on, even Jack Johnson found redemption. Now, leisure sports became part of the black American lifestyle. African Americans formed sports clubs. One of the most enduring was the American Tennis Association, ATA. Which organized matches and events across the eastern seaboard.
There were farmers, lunches, and things going on, especially for those that didn't play. We always had a lot of activities. And the Atlanta tournament was one of the most beautiful things that I've ever seen in my life because it was run perfectly. Perfectly. Beautiful. And I learned a lot.
The 1920s was a time when some black Americans attained a small piece of the American dream. But like players in the ATA, they did so in their own world, separate and unequal. The most renowned heroes of the black sporting world were the men who took part in the All-American pastime. Originally formed in the 20s by premier pitcher Rube Foster, the National Negro League flourished and then died as the Great Depression took hold of America. By the early 1930s, the country was in despair. Bread lines were commonplace, and economic opportunity was a scarce commodity. The Depression hit hardest in the black neighborhoods, where it was already tough to get a break or get a job. But the self-reliance movement begun by segregation and fostered during the Renaissance led to the rebirth of the Negro Leagues.
1932, we played the first recognized black World Series, Yankee Stadium. We had 47,000. We played the New York Lincoln Giants. Satchel Paige pitched the first game in our corner. In the seventh inning, I hit a home run in upper deck with the bases loaded and drove in 4 runs, and we beat them.
The biggest rivalry was between the team owned by Gus Greenlee, the Pittsburgh Crawfords, and the Homestead Grays, owned by Cum Posey.
Gus only knew people in the rackets. Cum himself, out in Homestead where he lived, he was on the school board, he was a councilman. The two were just different. Homestead is right outside of Pittsburgh. They had some of the best ball players in the league. They had fellows like Josh Gibson and Buck Leonard and those kind of people, you know. And they were a rivalry.
We played 4 games a day. You ever heard of that? We played 9:45 in the morning, 1:45. Then get in the bus, go 50 miles down to Virginia, cross the line and play. When we get back home, go to bed, it's 5 o'clock. And my wife would fish me a steak or some pork chops or something. When I wake up the next morning, they're still on the table. I just went to sleep and left it. So tired.
The owners kept their teams alive by a part-time schedule of games against other league members and by barnstorming. Traveling around the countryside, playing against hometown teams in the north and the south.
They just had these old rickety buses right in because Jim Crow trains were not for these players.
Sometimes you'd be in a town down south in Alabama or Mississippi. They'd want you to go in the back of a restaurant, sit on a box, and eat. And some of the boys had too much pride, they wouldn't do it. And if you pick up the holes to drink some water, he'd say, put them holes down, nigga. White folks get you a Coca-Cola bottle. It was awful. We took a beating. But if we don't keep playing, they wouldn't be playing today.
You know, there was an accommodation that we as a people learned to make to that sort of thing. When you can't do anything about something, you make it a stepping stone for something else that makes you happy.
In black baseball, you had a business that involved only people of color. The ball clubs were African American. The owners were African American. The sites where they played were African American in the main. At that time, the only other businesses we had that was run by black people were a few newspapers and insurance companies. This is the one phase of sports that they owned and dictated how the game was to be run.
Despite the hardship of the times, the players of the Negro Leagues were becoming legends in the black communities where they played.
I didn't know anything about Negro baseball. There was no blacks in baseball. There was no talk about blacks ever getting a chance to play baseball. I'm like Buck Leonard and Josh Gibson, you know.
The most colorful character of all was a tall, self-assured pitcher named Satchel Paige.
Now you're talking about something. He'd never be no move like him, I don't think. We used to call everybody off the field but me and him in this. But as the day come up there, he's moved down.
People saying that he could make the ball look like a pea. He could make the ball look smaller than anybody I ever faced. He's too hard. I just went for his strength. I couldn't. I came up from down in Mobile and I was throwing rocks like you heard him say. I could throw rock streaks. I used to kill boys with rocks. There's no reason so about it.
Judy Johnson or Jimmy Crutchfield and Double Duty Radcliffe to see him pitch a game in the morning, then catch one in the afternoon. And Oscar Owens, my favorite, 150-pounder for the Homestead Braves, who could pitch 5 innings with his left hand and the next 4 innings with his right hand, all in the same game. And don't you think people didn't turn out to see that?
The Negro Leagues provided something to look forward to in these hardest of hard times. At the depth of the Great Depression, they staged the rivalry of rivalries. The East-West All-Star Classic. Held in August each year, it became so popular that even the white press come to game.
One year we say we draw 19,000. That was nothing. The next year we draw 43. Then we went up to 57,000. We moved back to me.
The lady used to come to the ballpark all dressed up like they come from church or something, you know.
I can remember how exciting it was. Yes, it was an exciting time.
And the games were always good. 2-1, 4-3, never 6-0, never 10-0. They were very, very close games.
African Americans took pride in their teams, and they were proudest when their idols played against the white major leaguers.
We played the Yankee Stadium on a Friday night and a Sunday afternoon. I pitched against Satchel Paige, and we had 2 great ball games. They won one, we won one. We had over 100,000 people in Yankee Stadium for those 2 ball games.
I got to see all these ball players in action. Ted Williams and Ty Cobb, and I got to see them, and I also had an opportunity to see the Negro League players. And it said to me, and here's something wrong. Anybody playing all they could play to that big. That's the way I felt, you know.
Because when we started Barnstorm, when we ran them all over the country, so much so that their commissioners stopped them from playing us.
Kennesaw Mountain Landis prohibited play between the two teams because barnstorming games competed with major league games. And so the ban on admittance of blacks into the white majors continued. And to much of white America, the National Negro League remained unknown. In the less popular sport of basketball, the Depression destroyed the organized league. The only way to survive was to play any team, black or white. All takers were welcome, anything to stay alive. The most successful were the Renaissance Big Five, the Wrens, and the original Celtics.
The Wrens and the Celtics were not afraid to play off of what they knew was fans' anticipation of a white team beating a black team or a black team beating a white team.
Robert Douglas fulfilled his dream when he formed the Wrens. They were the black team to beat.
We were a ducket because the ducket hadn't been thought of about that time. But the ball handler per se was very exceptional.
They all could run. Pat Jenkins was like a blur. You know,
the man would steal the ball from him before he'd get halfway down the court.
Jenkins had overtaken him and gotten the ball back and came flying back up the court.
That was our forte. Speed, good ball handling, good ball passing, and perfect defense.
Skill was not enough. Basketball teams had to go to the fans to make a living.
Barnstorming was an experience in its own. I was from the North, and the thing that happened below the cotton curtain was something that you had to learn to deal with.
Imagination also helped to bring in the fans. Originally a serious basketball team, Abe Saperstein's Harlem Globetrotters barely survived. But as their antics became their game, they became stars.
A lot of people have a misconception. They thought the Trotters couldn't play. He started to play. But they found out it was more advantageous to them to do what they did.
White audiences and the white media was being drawn much more to the Globetrotters, giving them more accolades. Because it fit, again, this white stereotype, what black people were supposed to be like.
Other teams relied on serious competition to bring in the fans. Over time, the Wrens and Celtics developed a friendship that only respect and mutual dependence could foster.
It was a friendship of knowing each other and a warm friendship of trying to beat the other dude that's trying to beat you. And we all respect each other for that because that's what the ball game is all about.
The Wrens became two-time world champions, yet officially considered only Negro champs. When the season ended, their success on the court was not enough to carry them throughout the year.
Well, you got first player basketball, like I said. You had to put some grips on the table. You better have to get yourself a job. You had to worry about paying Mr. Charlie at the end of the month, pay your rent and so forth, things like that.
You were guys that played at the top of the game who were, in several cases, inducted into the Basketball Hall of Fame, became painters, became bus drivers, became cab drivers, and the one who became a New York City policeman went off duty and called to a burglary scene when the white cop, uniform cops arrived, gunned him down because they thought he was the burglar.
Racial divisions ran deep as Americans desperately tried to pull themselves out of the doldrums. Mass protests were prompted by news from Germany about the treatment of Jews.
The principle that all citizens stand equal before the law is a test of civilized government. Mr. Hitler's violation of these common rights in their application to Jewish citizens of Germany is a challenge to civilization.
In the spring of 1936, the world prepared to send its athletes to Berlin for the Olympic Games. Rumor of a boycott was spread as Americans grappled with the question of equality in Germany. A second-class citizen at home, Ohio State track star Jesse Owens was America's hope for Olympic glory.
He was a beautiful runner, running just like a machine. It was beautiful to watch him. Perfect form. Perfect.
on the track scene at the National Intercollegiate in Ann Arbor, Michigan. He set 3 world records and tied a 4th in the span of 45 minutes to become an immediate celebrity. As the Olympics approached, Owen's fame continued to grow.
I'm going to try to bring back 3 pounds, that is, in the 100 meters, 200 meters, and the broad jump.
The U.S. Olympic team set sail for Berlin on the SS Manhattan on July 15th. The opening ceremonies were conducted amidst Nazi ideology and the Olympic philosophy of world unity.
That was very exciting. And all the various countries marching to the stadium. Very, very exciting. We had blue blazers, white trousers, straw hat, and little flat pack straw hats with the red, white, and blue strap band.
Hitler opened the games with the hope of proving his theory of Aryan superiority. His racial propaganda was challenged on the second day when Jesse Owens set a world record in the 100 meters and won the gold.
Owens is ahead. Sundberg and Bolsman are breaking. Owens out, challenges his makeup. Metcalf comes up. But Owens wins in 1.6.
Competition was grand. I was very glad to come out on top. Thank you for coming.
Some observers said that after Owen's performance, Jetman no longer personally congratulated the athletes. But Owen was not finished. The next day, he shattered the Nazi belief by setting 2 Olympic records and winning the gold in the broad jump and the 200 meters.
And what's so significant about Jesse's performance is that every time he set foot on the track, he tied a record. And this is what caused his popularity. Jesse, that's all they were saying. 2 things happened when Owens became the big champion. It was discovered that all Americans could sort of rally around and identify with a black person symbolizing the country. That was very important. The other thing was is that people saw the Olympics as basically being a confrontation between the United States and Nazi Germany.
Other black Americans challenged Hitler's assertions as well. John Woodruff's 800-meter final amazed spectators.
I decided to use a little strategy. Got in second position and tried to preserve my kick. Then all the other athletes crowded right around me, see. And I couldn't get out of this ball. So the only way that I could get out without fouling somebody was to stomp. I stomped. Let the athletes proceed ahead of me. I ran out into the third lane and around them and won the race. In fact, I ran more than 800 meters to win the race, you see.
These accomplishments tore at the fabric of Hitler's theories. America, despite its racial beliefs, seemed to pull together for its athletes, black and white, until the 400-meter relay. Jesse Owens and John Wyckoff were substituted for the 2 Jewish members of the Olympic team, Marty Glickman and Sam Stoller.
We knew why. But we kind of felt that it was because of their religion that they weren't permitted to run, you see. But that wasn't right.
The triumph of the black athletes and the omission of the Jewish ones led many Americans to question their beliefs about race, religion, and tolerance. The Olympic team returned from Berlin, American hero. Jesse Owens returned to offers for endorsements that never came to be. Stripped of his amateur status because he did not run exhibition meets in Europe, Owens was faced with making a living during the Great Depression.
He was reduced to, at one time, you know, racing horses. Maybe some people considered entertainment. I thought it was demeaning personally. But he had to stay alive.
Jesse Owens temporarily fell on hard times. Eventually, his image as a clean-cut American hero would pull him through. The mid-30s bore yet another African-American star. After 22 years, the country was willing to welcome a black boxer back into the media spotlight. But Joe Louis bore no resemblance to his predecessor.
The idea is they want no association in the American mind between Jack Johnson and Joe Louis. When Jack Johnson would try to come to a Joe Louis camp, he was thrown out. They were both black, but there the comparison ends.
Louis received lessons in personal hygiene and proper table manners. He was instructed to knock out his challenges rather than risk a judge's decision. Above all, he was advised not to smile after beating a white opponent.
For white Americans, he was considered respectful.
Thank you.
He wasn't a particularly articulate man. He was quiet by nature.
Well, I felt fine. If I had a tough fight, and I fought a tough man.
I never heard the man brag. Whenever he won, he was lucky. Joe Louis had the greatest impact on my life, the kind of person that I wanted to be.
Louis's skill astonished many people.
A tremendous upset, my lord. Louis is in
trouble. His only loss had been to the German Max Schmeling in June 1936.
Louis goes down.
Joe Louis was becoming a household name.
Now let us talk about the brown bomber. Tell the nation his story. Let us talk about the brown bomber. Do you want the fight? Well, now stop and pretend
he had us all walking the streets with boxing gloves around our neck, working out on the corner.
He was a great fighter. Great fighter. And of course, when Joe Louis went past the second round and didn't knock somebody out, everybody thought, easy losing it, you know, when you go through. They expect so much of you, you know, when you get great.
I know this to be a fact in my hometown. Both the white and black churches, if he's fighting on Wednesday night, there was no prayer meeting.
That generation thought of Joe Louis as God because here was a man, the way they saw it, who had black management, who stood up and fought these fights mostly against white opponents. He had very few black opponents.
At age 23, Louis got a shot at the title. For African Americans, everything was riding on the fight. The champ, James Braddock, at age 32, was still the favorite.
I feel very confident that I've stopped Joe Louis inside of 8 rounds.
Of the 45,000 people attending the championship bout at Comiskey Park, almost half were African American. Louis was knocked down in the first round. Black America's heart skipped a beat.
I dusted, I wiped the floor up. I did everything to keep busy, to keep from dropping dead if he lost. Because that's the way they felt about it.
Louis waited for time to take its toll on the champ. By the 8th round, Joe was in command of the fight. 1 minute and 10 seconds later, he became the new heavyweight champion of the world. The Brown Bomber was king. He would open his own night spot. He would have a soda named after him. And he would star in Hollywood movies.
I want to get ahead.
Joe came along at a time when we needed a hero. We needed a symbol. Remember this, he was the symbol for all classes, the poor, the medium, white collar, blue collar, no collar. He carried them all.
Although Joe Louis was becoming an all-American hero, in Louis's mind, he had one more test before he would consider himself the champ. He wanted a rematch with the one opponent who had put him down, Germany's Max Schmeling. But war was on the horizon.
Never before has our American civilization been in such danger as now. Danger against which we must prepare.
And so Joe Louis, Max Schmeling took on kind of an international good guys versus bad guys. Now Joe Louis personified America, an America that transcended race. I think also he was important for the idea that we are fighting a Nazi racist ideology, and that by embracing Lewis, it said something about us. It said that we do not follow the same ideology.
The first time I've ever heard an announcer called a black man an American was in Smelling and Joseph's right. They called Joseph Lewis the American. And, you know, that just sort of cut me deep.
On June 22nd, 1938, a calm Joe Lewis weighed in at 198 pounds.
When the 10-second buzzer came on, and Joe turned around, he looked at Smelling, and before the 10 seconds was up, the bell rang, he just moved towards him.
Around the country, the streets were deserted. Everyone was listening to the fight.
I don't think there was a black household that didn't. And if you didn't have a radio, you went 3 or 4 blocks to your neighbor who had a radio. Remember now, everybody didn't have radios in those days.
Explosive right to the jaw, hurts Max Miller. Joe Lewis, all over Max Smalley here in round one. Ripping punches to the head. Joe steps back.
The second right hand that hit him.
A dynamite right to the jaw.
It sounded like someone smacked a wet rag all over Yankee Stadium. It looked like it paralyzed the muscles in Smalley's face. His mouth flew open and his eyes were glazed. That was it. I never got a chance to take any notes. Then, of course, my boss from the paper, he didn't get a chance to see anything.
Ripping punches by the Brown bombers, Jim Sterling, Gallagher.
We fought Max Smith the second time.
Ripping right.
Not tipped up, took the crown. Way down in Jericho, thousands of people are all glad to fight the greatest champ we've ever had.
Yeah, I was one of those guys that ran out the house with a keyboard and radio and had to tell that time right up down the street. Yeah, I don't know what he wanted.
And now, the entire white sports writing community has completely turned in his favor. This was the fight that transformed Joe Lewis into the great American hero. He was to maintain that status for as long as he lived, really. There probably has been no black athlete as beloved as Joe Lewis.
In 1941, with the bombing of Pearl Harbor, America was drawn into war. Japanese Americans were forced into internment camps, and young black men eager to serve signed up in order to fight for democracy abroad. Blacks were assigned to all black units with white commanders. Jim Crow extended even into the armed forces. Right. He was to be in the same country with blacks, he was in the same regiments, same navy with blacks, and they wanted to keep it that way. The government pumped money into the American economy to support the war effort, and the Great Depression came final to an end. Jim Crow laws made it tough for African Americans to take part in the new prosperity. Black labor leader A. Philip Randolph proposed a march on Washington. The threat of massive protest persuaded President Roosevelt to force government employers to hire African Americans. As blacks began to work side by side with their white countrymen, the march toward democracy at home gained momentum. Many African Americans protested, and some began to ask the unthinkable. Why couldn't blacks play in Major League Baseball? Black sports writers spearheaded a campaign to reintegrate the all-American pastime.
I would write to the owners and ask them if they thought that this was a proper thing to do. And I constantly petitioned Judge Landis, who was a commissioner of baseball at that time. But he never would give me an opportunity to talk to him.
In the fall of 1944, the man who had indicted Jack Johnson and fervently upheld the unwritten ban on blacks in baseball died of a heart attack.
I can't say that Landis's death gave me any particular pleasure, because I think death should not be pleasurable to anyone. But I did see an opportunity.
And it seemed that everybody who happened to be black, who was a baseball player, wanted to play in the major leagues, wanted a chance.
But then there were a lot of black people who didn't want that to happen.
The contention was that by working for desegregation, it meant throwing a lot of Negro baseball players out of work.
As the war continued, the Negro League flourished. They drew larger crowds than the white major leagues who used replacement players for those gone to war. Even an all-girl professional baseball league was formed rather than recruit a black player. These actions did not deter black sports writers in their crusade for equality on the field. The United States dropped two atomic bombs and the Second World War ended. Black columnist Ralph Matthews wrote, "After our armies had marched on Berlin and Tokyo, if the G.I. Joes, both colored and white, don't turn around and march on Washington, they will not have learned what they were fighting for."
Black people had become more assertive as a result of the war, and also it was becoming more and more difficult for whites to sort of fall back on the idea of custom to support racist ideology, because racism has seemed to be this horrible thing, and look what's been caused in the world as a result of this racism.
After President Roosevelt's mid-war death, Harry S. Truman took another step toward democracy.
"There is no justifiable reason for discrimination because of ancestry or religion or race or color."
In 1946, the unwritten ban on black players was lifted in Major League sports, not on the diamond, but on the gridiron. In March, the Los Angeles Rams recruited Woody Strode. In August, the NFL's rival, the All-American Football Conference, AAFC, signed two black players to their star team, the Cleveland Browns.
One of the greatest running backs of all time, Larry Mott, was on their team. Bill Willis is a Pro Football Hall of Famer. And you can go on and name several other players who were on the team at that time who were of African-American descent who figured very prominently in the success of the Cleveland Browns.
Before the free substitution rule, players performed on offense and defense. Marion Motley played fullback and linebacker, a situation that kept him constantly in the game and constantly in harm's way.
"Guy hit me or something, or knocked my helmet off, or I could get him to turn him around. He said, 'What you doing, Motley?' I said, 'I'm getting your number.' I said, 'Cause, you know, we played twice. We played you twice. If I don't get you today, I'll get you the next time. I could either run over, or you're on defense, I'll get him and hit him with the elbow.'"
Motley and Willis, like their African-American countrymen, no longer turned the other cheek. They were fighting back in their own ways, and they were gaining allies.
For 3 years, it went on. I would be getting up off the ground, and the referee would be standing, reaching for the ball. And when I'd get up, put my hand and push up off the ground, the player would take his foot and those days they had that hard rubber cleats. All my hand was scarred up and blue, just running in. And they never say it. So finally one day, the referee saw it, and he picked the ball up and started walking. So the guy that did that stepped on my hand, he said, 'What the hell is that for?' He said, 'Shut up and play ball. You know what it's for.' Walked off 15 yards and put the ball down. And that was the beginning of the change of the referees giving us a break."
3 years after it began, the AAFC folded into the NFL. 17 years after the merger, the NFL would be integrated on the field. Football and basketball admitted blacks with little notice. The baseball owners held out as long as they could. But the black sports writers' crusade was finally paying off.
Sam Lacy, Wendell Smith, Joe Bostic, and all those pioneers, they were the ones that opened the doors. They were the ones that opened eyes to the wrongness of the fact that these men could go away, fight and die, and they couldn't play Major League Baseball. They thought it was a crime. And it wasn't. It was a shame.
Still, it would take a special man to buck convention. When the co-owner of the Brooklyn Dodgers, Branch Rickey, embarked upon his experiment to reintegrate baseball, he faced the ire of the nation.
Branch Rickey believes in two things about sports. He just really thought it's unfair if people have talent to not be able to play a sport or do whatever it is they want to do. And the other is his belief in expanding economic markets.
Black All-Stars could draw 40,000, 50,000 people in Comiskey Park. There was money there. And later when I got to know Mr. Rickey better, he said one thing they noticed. Black people did not patronize white ball, but they did patronize their own.
Rickey signed a quick-tempered ex-Army lieutenant who had played briefly in the Negro League. Jackie Robinson was signed to the Dodgers' top farm team, the Montreal Royals. Like Joe Louis before him, Robinson was required to sign a contract that dictated his behavior. It stipulated that he could not show public rebuke for any actions taken against him for 3 years. When Branch Rickey told Jackie that you can't fight back, he meant it, because if you fight back, there's going to be riots. There's going to be people who will be killed because there will be this black man beating up, fighting with this white man. And that kind of thing can't happen. So, Jackie, if you can't do it my way, Branch Rickey would say to him, then there'll be no way at all.
He wasn't the type of person to take that.
Not Jackie.
He was very hot-headed. Can you imagine not being able to open his mouth or say anything in his own favor? It destroyed him from within.
Jackie was the right man at the right time, although he was not the best ball player. I thought that he was the kind of person who would adjust more quickly.
The signing of a black baseball player to the minor leagues drew nationwide criticism.
My dad was hired by Branch Rickey. What I remember about my dad's reaction was that he was not for it in the beginning.
If you were of what was then considered to be liberal, and was not a bad word to be a liberal in those days, obviously you were on Jackie Robinson's side and you cheered what he did. If you were what was then called a conservative, and probably still is called a conservative, you probably were not happy.
I never will forget what a manager of the Pittsburgh Pirates said in 1946. He said, they're hiring them niggas now. They're going to be white boy. Going to have to look for a job.
Despite opposition from the fans, the press, and members of the Dodgers organization, Branch Rickey completed the first phase of his plan. The second part was to sign a catcher, Roy Campanella, and a pitcher, Don Newcomb, who both went quietly to the New England minor league. On April 15, 1947, Jackie Robinson became a first baseman for the Brooklyn Dodgers.
He was a symbol of the destruction of the major league mind. He was the person that they resented most because he was the one that who had done the job.
Robinson accepted his position and turned his anger into school.
Jackie Robinson.
Blacks were thrilled to see the reintegration of baseball.
Yes, yes, Jackie, hit that ball.
But it also marked the beginning of the end for the Negro League.
Satchel Paige is mellow, so is Campanella. You come at Dobie too. But it's a natural fact, when Jackie comes to bat, the other team.
He wound up defining the role of a leader of the team. I don't know how many times he stole home in any one particular year. I just know that he won ball games by stealing home plate. It was incredible. I mean, that he did.
Eventually, Robinson was joined by Campanella and Newcomb. Branch Rickey did what he could to shelter them, but there was nothing he could do once they were on the field.
I remember one day in Cincinnati, we were on a team bus getting ready to go to the baseball stadium, and Jackie had a letter. In the letter it said, if you niggas come out to that baseball stadium, they were going to shoot all of you, because today is your last day to be with the Dodgers and play in this game of baseball. I said to Jackie after reading that, I said, what are you going to do? He said, I'm going home. I said, Roy, what are you going to do? He said, I'm going. And I said to Jackie, well, I'm going with you. If we die today, we're going to die together.
Dad went into Mr. Ricky and said, nobody can continue to take this stuff. This guy is going through stuff that no human being should be asked to endure. Mr. Ricky says, you're an honest, fair man, and people are going to react the same way as you do. This will not go on.
Racial taunts would continue at a diminishing rate for years to come. But Jackie Robinson had instilled in himself and his teammates a will to survive, to persevere, and above all, to win.
Now, I felt that Jackie was the forerunner of what was going to be an equal society. Ideally, that's what a lot of people thought. As I said, it didn't quite turn out that way.
All we wanted was a chance to show that we were Americans like everybody else, because if baseball was known as the great all-American sports pastime, why wasn't it all-American when we were given a chance to play the game? Other Negro leaguers, like Satchel Paige, eventually made it to the majors. But it would take 10 more years before each team had at least one black player. The long road to integration had only just begun in an America long separate and unequal. In the years following World War II, the door to integration was cracked open. Black America's disillusionment with the pace of progress gave birth to a new, more militant civil rights movement. Blacks were no longer asking for rights, but demanding them.
I've been concerned, and you're concerned, with decent civil rights for all black people.
Brown versus the Board of Education outlawed school segregation. The civil rights movement began to take shape. Rosa Parks refused to give up her seat on the bus, sparking the Montgomery bus boycott organized by a 26-year-old unknown minister.
Montgomery has been thrown into a peculiar position. We can well map out the strategy for the future of integration.
In many ways, the institution of sports contributed to the community's sense of betrayal. Joe Lewis was the symbolic conquering hero abroad, yet black soldiers fought in segregated combat units. Jesse Owens shattered the myth of Aryan supremacy in Nazi Germany, while white racism in the United States never abated. Jackie Robinson symbolized the promise of integration and the destruction of black institutions to achieve it. In 1950, the black presence in sports was meager and marginal. In the NFL, there were a total of 19 blacks playing, and of 17 NBA teams, there were just 3 black players in the league. Nowhere, though, was the nation's racism more dramatically entrenched than in the sport of tennis. The assault on this sport was from the unlikeliest of people, a shy, strong-willed girl from Harlem, whose race and social background went against everything that tennis stood for. Her name was Althea Gibson.
She was obviously a potential tennis champion. You could see it from the get-go. She was very competitive. She believed she can, if she come in here, she believed she could spit further than you. Anything you come up with, she could beat you doing it, you know.
She made things happen. So it's come to the net, put the point away, and that's it. She did not play around. She did not wait for people to make an error. She made you make the error.
Gibson cut her teeth in the All-Black American Tennis Association, but longed for the stronger competition found at the restricted and all-white United States Lawn Tennis Association.
I think the people at the top of the game were very uncomfortable in having her enter. In those days, the tournaments that mattered most to an American tennis player was the Eastern Grass Court Circuit. These were small, restricted clubs played at such places as the Longwood Cricket Club in Boston, Essex County Club, and these were all invitational events.
Gibson needed an ally from within, and she got one in Alice Marble. A former singles champion, Marble dominated tennis in the 30s. In July of 1950, she wrote an editorial which brought the USLTA much embarrassment.
If tennis is a game for ladies and gentlemen,
It's also time we acted a little more like gentle people and less like sanctimonious hypocrites. If Althea Gibson represents a challenge to the present crop of women players, it's only fair that they should meet that challenge on the courts where tennis is played.
A month later, Gibson broke through the color barrier and became the first African-American to compete at the U.S. Championships at Forest Hills. But the attitudes of the tennis establishment remained unchanged.
She went through quite a lot, I think, questioning and exams and things like that that a normal player wouldn't have to go through. They even did examinations to see whether she was not a man or because she was a tall, gangly individual. So it was kind of tough on her.
Her match with the experienced Louise Brough shook the seemingly unshakable tennis structure.
It was a sort of gradual breakthrough or breaking in that historic day. Lightning struck one of the eagles on the top of the stadium, knocking it off its pedestal. And I remember talking to her about that, and she said, yeah, that may have been a sign that things were changing.
Although Gibson lost to Brough, a door was cracked open. Unlike basketball, football, and baseball, where the pioneer was followed by a stream of athletes, Gibson traveled the country club road alone, tolerated but never embraced. Gibson failed to win a major tournament for the next 6 years.
So, Althea, not too long ago, you started branching out into show business. How's the new career coming?
Well, I think it's coming along all right, Ed. I've done a few things. I've written a book. I always wanted to be somebody, and I think it's a great story. And also, Ed, this is my first album. So now that's fine. Would you like to hear one of the selections?
Very much.
Wonderful. I think you will like it. It's around the world.
All around the world, I search for you. I travel on when hope was gone to keep a rendezvous.
Finally, Althea's beauty streak was ended, and in 1957, she became the first African-American to win Wimbledon.
You'd look at me.
She dominated tennis from 1956 through 1958, but as an amateur with no sponsorships, Gibson was unable to make a living. She pursued various other careers, including teaching, acting, and even a brief stint as the Globetrotters' opening act. Her triumphs propelled her into the record books, yet Gibson was never taken into the bosom of the United States. Like Jesse Owens, she was only a paper hero.
Well, you keep spells, eh?
Although the color line of tennis had been broken, the deeply rooted racism in golf reduced the black presence to a vaudeville act. With this mentality, black golfers had virtually no hope of breaking into the segregated PGA.
Well, the thing about golf is you got to understand that golf was the first sport to integrate. If you consider a white golfer and a black caddy to be integration, that was integration as far as golf was concerned. There was a reason why country clubs looked like plantations, because they were plantations. It was an extension of that mentality.
To preserve its plantation atmosphere, the PGA inserted a Caucasian clause in 1943 that prevented blacks from competing in PGA events. Charlie Sifford would change that. Sifford dominated play in the All-Black United Golfers Association and was set to prove that he could compete on a larger stage. But he was ignored by many tournament officials who would invoke the Caucasian clause at their own discretion.
Everything was a fight. You had to fight for the tennis. You had to fight for the golf. You had to fight for everything.
But if there was anyone you wanted fighting for you, it was Charlie Sifford.
Charlie was a very mean golfer, and I think that's what it takes. You can't be nice and composed. Charlie would sit on the putting green and clean his nails with a knife before he would enter tournaments. This long.
Sifford's struggle caught the attention of those within the black community when Jackie Robinson wrote a letter in his behalf.
Since Charlie is endeavoring to make a living at his chosen craft, it constitutes a basic denial of economic opportunity when he is barred from membership in the PGA. Not only should court action be considered, but I feel the issue is one for a thorough investigation by the Civil Rights Commission.
Finally, the PGA relented. In 1959, Sifford was admitted as an approved player, a first for blacks in golf. 2 years later, the Caucasian clause was finally removed. Racism was not. Beyond the golf course and around the country, the sit-in movement took off when students in Greensboro faced the boycott protesting segregated lunch counters.
This was a period of trade-off.
More African Americans were playing Major League Baseball, closing the door on the Negro Leagues forever. Ironically, the black colleges led the way for integration and unwittingly led to their own undoing. Black universities were historically where many of the world's greatest athletes were developed and where talented female athletes were nurtured. At Tennessee State, Coach Ed Temple took the concept to a new level with the Tennessee Tiger Bells.
He always said that first you were a lady, second you were a scholar, and third a Tiger Bell, in that order.
The first thing you had to do is to prove that young ladies could be a young lady and still be an athlete. So the first thing came in my mind, I wanted them to look good. And one of my mottos early in my career was, I want foxes, not oxes.
Men believe that, you know, women involved in sports, you know, you had problems, you didn't look feminine and all those things. I had to explain to the men that it would not harm the women or hurt the women for them to participate in track and field. That it would just make them a stronger individual and that it would not hinder them from having babies.
Temple's star pupil came along in the summer of 1960. She was a tall, attractive sprinter who pulled female athletes from the margins of sports to center stage. Her name was Wilma Rudolph.
Wilma was graceful in her running. She reminded me of Jesse Owens. Fluid stride, beautiful form, and she had that smile. She had that pleasing personality.
There had been great female athletes before her, but Wilma was the first to achieve international acclaim. Rudolph became known as the fastest woman alive, but as a child, had obstacles to overcome.
I was very small. I think it was at the age of 3 or 4. I had polio, and there was a special type shoe that I had to wear at this age. I was carried back and forth to Nashville, which is about 45 miles from my hometown, about twice a week for different treatments. It gives you something to push for. It gives you determination, and it makes you want to do it. It's building from within.
Wilma changed the concept of the female track and field athlete for the African Americans as well as the white, that we could compete with the Europeans, that we were highly competitive, and that we did have what it took to be world class. And she proved it in 60.
100,000 crowd the Olympic Stadium in Rome for the elaborate ceremonies that open the 17th modern Olympiad.
With a bronze medal from the 56 Olympics already in tow, Rudolph would better that at the 1960 Games in Rome. Wilma's celebrity skyrocketed when she brought home gold medals in the 100, 200, and the 400-meter relay.
When we was in Germany after the Olympics, what the Germans claimed her as being a German because her name was Rudolph, a German name, and she couldn't put her sweat bone down on her track shoes. Everybody just wanted a souvenir from Wilma. We got on the bus. We tried to get her on the bus. They was hollering, Wilma, Wilma. They even shook the bus. They just wanted to see her. They just wanted to touch her.
Unlike Gibson, Rudolph used the visibility she gained in track to participate in a movement that continued to gain momentum. She began by sensitizing her hometown of Clarksville, Tennessee, and refused to participate in a parade in her honor unless it was integrated.
She knew that this was not right,
and that she was not going to be in the parade, but the parade was segregated. Because they didn't even speak about Clarksville. They said Wilma Rudolph from Clarksville, Tennessee. They didn't say Wilma Rudolph from Black Clarksville, Tennessee. They said from Clarksville, Tennessee.
And that was the first time that they had an integrated parade in Clarksville, the first time they had a big integrated banquet. And I never will forget the mayor got up and he talked about piano. He said, you got white keys and you got black keys. But in order to get good harmony, you got to play the white keys and the black keys. Both of them got to be playing together in order to get good music. And that set the tone for integration in Clarksville.
Why have a baby? Children, one day live in a nation where they will not be judged by the color of their skin, but by the content of their character. I have a dream.
In 1963, more than 200,000 protesters marched on Washington. Police attacked demonstrators in Birmingham, and the country lost a beloved president. The escalation of the civil rights protest made it virtually impossible for anyone in the black community to remain neutral over the issue of race. For the growing number of black professional athletes, the dilemma of race was compounded by the paradox of celebrity.
As an athlete, people adored you in the superficial manner. It was through the fact that you pleased them as you exhibited this physical force, or even your mental ability on the field. As a man, they didn't pay very much attention to you. The irony is that when I played for 80,000 people in Cleveland Stadium, they would cheer. And then I couldn't go to a particular restaurant because I was a black man. So that cheering went out the window. I was dealing with why I couldn't go into that restaurant. You see, I didn't want to integrate. I just wanted my rights.
The new athlete, no longer pioneers or tokens, played with the force of men who knew they belonged. The catalyst for this new attitude were Jim Brown and Bill Russell, two athletes who refused to separate themselves from the swirling currents of race and economics in the black community.
Listen, you could take, now there, let's say there are 22 million Negroes in the United States. You could give everyone of $1 million and you can change anything.
Why is that?
You just wouldn't change anything because this is the thing that's about pizza. Listen, economics, sure, this is important, very important. But this whole thing is about people.
Are you saying then that there are white people who will never accept Negro people? Is that what you mean?
Sure, and there are Negro people who will never accept white people.
When Bill Russell signed with the Celtics in 1956, he was the only black player on the team. But he had a reputation as a winner. At the University of San Francisco, he led the Dons to consecutive national championships. Russell so dominated the boards, the NCAA had to double the foul line from 6 feet to 12.
What impressed me most about Bill Russell was just the fact that he was very consistent. On the court, he wanted to win every single game. Now, this is every single game, bar none. It wasn't the height of the egotism at all. He just thought that he was what he was. The best defensive player in the game.
Historians say no one blocked shots before Russell. This much is for certain. No one blocked shots like Russell. No player created an intimidating presence on defense like Russell. He originated a whole new style of play.
There was no one smarter than Russell. I mean, the concept of blocking shots is one thing. The concept of blocking shots and blocking in such a way, in such an angle, so he could grab the block shot and then have the presence of mind to begin the legendary Celtics fast break, all within one motion.
Russell led the Celtics to their first NBA championship in 1957. But while Russell was cheered in the Boston Garden, he had a love-hate relationship with the city itself.
People don't realize that Bill Russell suffered a lot while he played in Boston, even though they were winning championships. That did not quail, did not stymie some of the racism that he faced, not only for himself, but for his family as well.
I can remember him telling me of the difficulty of trying to purchase a house in Boston. Without them knowing who he was, he bought this house, and there were people throwing trash on the lawn, yelling obscenities, calling his home, doing all kind of crazy things
because they didn't want any blacks in the area. Once they found out that he was a star player for the Boston Celtics, then the cookies came, then the flowers came. And Bill Russell, in my opinion, never really got over that because he felt that he was accepted because he was an athlete and not because of the person.
Russell was the first to take a stand, and it didn't begin or end in Boston. At an exhibition game in Lexington, Kentucky, the black players were denied access to the hotel restaurant. Russell spoke up.
Russell said, you know, Red, we don't want to play the game because we don't like the treatment that we're getting here. And Red said, well, wouldn't it be better to play the game, let the press get a bunch of this, and wouldn't that be a much better approach to let the world know what's going on down here? And Russell said, no. He said, if we don't play the game, that's message enough right there. Bill Russell's symbol to us wasn't that we saw him walking up and down streets, you know, marching, because Bill didn't do those things. Bill's effect for us was that he always stood as a man. I mean, when he spoke, it didn't matter what the color of the person he was speaking to. It was obvious that he was saying it to that man, whatever the color.
Is there any of you young people here that would like to be President of the United States, Secretary of State, Ambassador of the United Nations? If you'd like to, don't give it up. You don't have to give it up. Because in spite of everything, I want you to remember one thing. You can do anything that you want to do, if you want to do it bad enough. Thank you very much.
Destined to be a leader, Russell was named player coach of the Celtics in 1966, the first black head coach ever in the history of the NBA.
The New Yorkers run into a giant killer. Number 32, Jimmy Brown, makes tissue paper of the giant line. There's no stopping the great man.
Jim Brown's entrance onto the scene was part of a steady progression of blacks in the NFL. They were a new breed of athletes, speed, flash, and independent spirits. As a rookie, Jim Brown led the league in rushing, and he continued his feat in 8 of the 9 seasons he played. As he became a greater force on the playing field, he spoke out more loudly.
If all we have to do is play football, it'd been easy. Based upon the political system and, you know, situation in the country at that time, we had to carry ourselves a certain way. And because I was the so-called star of the team, I had the power to guide the individuals and show some leadership, and I took advantage of that.
Cleveland Browns' great all-pro fullback has traded his famous number 32 jersey for a business suit. This is the headquarters of the Negro Industrial and Economic Union, of which Brown is co-founder.
We are trying to help the Negro people, period. We have a youth program. We have a program of financing businesses. We have many programs because we feel it is necessary to have many programs to reach all of the Negroes that are in need.
Jim Brown's Black Economic Union was formed through the solidarity of successful black athletes and entrepreneurs in an attempt to create greater opportunities for blacks in business.
Your organization is the first time in the history of professional athletics where a black man have a chance now to make money off of the field that they have made famous.
When I came up with the concept, it was readily picked up by a lot of individuals because they had some kind of knowledge that this would be the best way to bring about change. And I combined the athlete with the young MBAs. And the combination was a very powerful one because they understood if we got economic power, then that would be the power that would bring about the greatest change.
Through that union, we began to push blacks in the community to reach out for a piece of the pie, train yourselves. In fact, we set up training programs to teach blacks how to get into business, how to maintain your acumen in business, how to go get the money. But it made it all of us very, very strong because we felt that we had something to present to the community.
Brown's Black Economic Union picked up steam, opening offices in several cities, and endeavored to pull in every significant black athlete in the country. The athlete they had in mind was a charismatic young heavyweight from Louisville, Kentucky.
Cassius Clay became heavyweight champion on February 25, 1964, in one of the great upsets in boxing, when Charles Sonny Liston failed to answer the bell for the seventh round.
Hold it.
He's an act. He's entertainment. He's all mouth. He's just this wonderful, vibrant character.
He was not self-effacing. He was demanding of respect. He was demanding of recognition. And so he became kind of an icon for the new modern black athlete.
Cassius is not my name no more.
Officially Muhammad Ali now.
Muhammad Ali, right. Muhammad Ali, that's my name.
Malcolm X became the first black leader to understand the urgency of bringing black athletes into the political fold. Muhammad Ali became the Nation of Islam's most famous congress. Public opinion was mixed. He was either loved or hated. With Muhammad Ali dominating his opponents and the business of boxing.
Bob Arum, when I started talking about having Muhammad Ali control all of his business affairs, that all the ancillaries now could be controlled by a company that Ali controlled. And so we put together a company called Main Bout, which created opportunities for black athletes to exhibit the fight via closed circuit, which was the first time that happened in history. So Ali became the first major athlete to take control of all of his business affairs.
Ali's success did not prevent him from being called to serve his country.
His draft board changes his draft status from being ineligible to being eligible for the draft. And when this happens, he is besieged by reporters, absolutely besieged.
Ladies and gentlemen, Mr. Muhammad Ali has just refused to be inducted into the United States Armed Forces.
And boom, there's the story. Then he becomes truly political.
I said that I'm going to be a man, I'm going to fight it legally. If I lose it, I'm just going to jail.
In one defiant act, Ali fused both civil rights and anti-war movements. He became a compelling symbol for his generation.
I got a call from Herbert Muhammad, who was his manager at the time, the son of Elijah Muhammad, and Herbert said to me secretly that they would not mind Ali going into the service. But publicly, they couldn't take that stance. So I said, if I got the most powerful black athletes in the country to have a meeting in my office in Cleveland, and we could talk to Ali and try to find out the reason that he didn't want to go. The night before I talked to Ali, I knew that he wasn't going to go in no service.
After about 2.5 hours of discussion, and I might add very friendly discussion, we decided that in our hearts, the champ is sincere in his religious beliefs.
I mean, he was threatened in every way, told to apologize, otherwise they wouldn't let him fight. And he stood up and proclaimed himself a black Muslim at the time. That was the worst thing you could ever do.
Who's the heavyweight champion of the world?
When Ali was stripped of his title, he became more than a sports hero. He became a legend. Ali was embraced as a courageous dissenter who symbolized the conflict that divided the country.
It doesn't matter whether you agree with him being a Muslim or not, or whether you agree with his stand against the war or not. It was just that he defined himself and said, I'm not going to let white people define me or the white establishment define me. He defined himself on a huge stage at a time when black people were very interested in reshaping and remolding themselves as a people.
A season of frustration. Racial unrest. Senseless war, inner city riots, the loss of a dream.
The mood of the 60s was dark and somber, and merely because you're a professional athlete, it does not defend you from that.
When I was asked how did I feel about the unrest in the U.S. and what was happening, the mistreatment of blacks, I would always say that I grew up with it, I understand it, I know what it is, I feel something has to be done with it. And he used to say where the battlefield is it on the athletic field, or is it is in politics? Something needs to be changed, and somebody has to make a statement.
The 1968 Olympic trial set the stage for the most dramatic political protest in modern sports history. Black athletes debated the form their protest would take. San Jose State Professor Harry Edwards called for a boycott of the games in Mexico City.
It became very, very clear that sport was much like the rest of society, the same kinds of limitations, the same kinds of ideological assumptions, the same kinds of constraints on opportunity and on virtually every other dimension of black life that you found in the rest of society.
We will let you know about the future of your Olympic team when we deem it proper and when we feel that you can handle that kind of information. Right now, we just don't think that you're ready.
In sports, I think, people looked at an athlete and they listened to what he had to say. And Dr. Edwards was smart enough to look at that and say, hey, we need to say more things than how fast we ran the 100 or how long we hit a ball or how far we shot a jump shot. We need to start speaking out. And he started to organize folks and started to make these folks say and do some things that society became very uncomfortable with.
The black community was divided over this new militancy and the possibility of a boycott.
Well, I deplore the idea of where politics will enter into the Olympic Games because, you know, as you know, the Olympic Games were set up to dispel any political or religious faith that, you know, that might be invoked into the Games itself.
If today the conditions were the same and the Negro was breaking in and I was that Negro breaking in, I would join these protests so that my children and their children wouldn't have to go through the same thing that I went through trying to break down discrimination.
After a year of debate over the boycott, black team members decided to join their fellow Olympians in Mexico City, but they were still uncertain about what to do to call attention to conditions in black America.
There had been meetings inside the Olympic Village about what are we going to do as athletes when we go to compete, how are we going to express to the world that the unfair treatments of blacks in America. And there was no plan. There was no master plan that this is how you do it, this is what you do.
We could not come to a consensus that would unite everybody. You know, everybody tie a string around your finger. Everybody do this. Everybody do that. So the decision was made. Everybody would do their own thing.
On the fifth day of the Olympics, two black Americans made a statement.
John Carlos right now is Carlos is fifth, and he's just got me fifth. Smith has done it.
Two-hundred-meter medalists Tommy Smith and John Carlos stunned the world by raising their gloved fists in protest.
It was just like anybody going on the victory stand, and everybody was in the stands were like, "What's happening here?" And we were all shocked, and we were all—I think we all stood more to attention at the national anthem than ever because we were like, "What is going on?"
The right glove that I wore on my right hand signifies the power within black America.
You could almost hear the wind blowing around my fist. It would just stay quiet. Then there was a buzz. But I heard Lee Evans very, very vividly say, "Oh, shit."
And the next thing I know, people were beginning to mobilize their forces. And the idea was to get these guys out of the Olympic Village. Just get rid of them.
Why are you going, Carlos?
We're going home.
The USOC gave John Carlos and Tommy Smith 24 hours, I do believe, to leave Mexico City. They also told us to come to the Olympic quarters so they can take our medals back.
And I asked a question. I said, okay, if you're going to kick them out of the village, are you going to use their medal count, too, in the U.S. medal count? Are you going to do that? Nobody answered that question. And if you remember, the Soviet Union at that time had occupied Prague, Czechoslovakia. And a Czech gymnast in Mexico City won a bunch of medals. And every time on the victory stand, she made a protest.
And again, she has turned her head
to the right and down, just as she did at the last ceremony. This does not appear to be an accident.
No one ever made an issue of that one. And I just thought, wow, there's another indication of the ideas that, yeah, there is some difference in this country. There is very definitely some difference.
Smith and Carlos did make a difference since their medals were included in the final count. Black Olympians took home nearly half the medals won by the U.S. team.
Well, you had an opportunity to listen to the history of black athletes. It tells you a lot about what people have had to go through that happen to be African American. We didn't finish it, and I don't know if I will finish it, but I wanted to let you know that we started back not at the very beginning, but we started where you had an opportunity to see exactly how much black athletes had to go through. I can remember my father having to go through some of this myself. He was a fantastic football player. Well, this has been Getting It Done, and I have been your host, Dr. Walter Dean, and hopefully when we do this again, we'll finish it so you can hear the total elements of the history of black athletes. Have a good evening.